And now, broadcasting live on Star Worldwide Networks, it's time for Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery with Dr. William Nelson. If you suffer from addiction to opiate pain relievers, heroin, alcohol, or other substances, we're here to give you hope and help you overcome your addiction. Now, here's your host, Dr. Nelson.
Addiction is a problem that obviously affects everybody and families all over the world, and not only in the United States, but in Europe and in Sweden. And today we have a guest that's calling in all the way from Stockholm. Shama Pearson is a woman who is an innovator, an entrepreneur, and a mother of four who's dedicated her life to grow in self-love and inspire others to do the same. She believes that once we love ourselves, everything else falls in place. And but this dedication to herself didn't come easily. She has battled depression for a long time since she was very young, and her depression led her to a bout with alcohol dependence and actually had multiple suicide attempts. Today she's works as a model, an influencer, a health coach, and has a podcast called From Darkness to Light. And she's now in the process of writing a book on depression and suicide. So all the way from Stockholm, Sweden. I guess I was going to say good morning, but it's probably not morning. I got to remember it's about 8 or 10 hours away. So it's probably for you. Good evening.
Good evening. Good evening. And thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for coming on with the advent of, I think, Swedish technology. I think Skype was invented or formulated in Sweden, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it's true. And you are right, it's quite late. It's 7 o'clock in Sweden, and it's really, okay, really dark.
Oh yeah, but isn't it in the summertime, don't you have light well into like 10 or 11 o'clock at night?
In the summertime, we have like light 24 hours a day. Some part of Sweden, the sun never, you know, sets.
Yeah, I didn't realize how long north and south Sweden is. My youngest child, Nelson, spent a year going to high school in a high school outside of Stockholm. So are you familiar with, do you know, I don't know how to say it because I don't pronounce it improperly, but it's called Älvsjö, Stockholm.
Älvsjö.
Okay. Yes. I can't say, make my mouth do that. So Älvsjö.
So it's almost like an elf, you know, but it's Älvsjö.
Yeah.
I think the sjö is most difficult to pronounce.
Yeah.
It's
no
typical
kidding.
Swedish. Yes.
Yeah, and then They live there, which is, I think, about 10 miles southwest of downtown Stockholm. And then they went to high school in a place called Victor Rydberg. And that's Jarlaplan.
At Jarlaplan. Exactly. No, it's quite close to where I live, actually, Jarlaplan.
Oh, yeah. Well, my kid Nelson said that the school was in a beautiful part of town. So you must live in a lovely part of town.
No, I do. It's very, very green, and it's a lot of water close to where I live, and I'm very super privileged to live exactly here. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, my child loved her time in Sweden and told me, "Dad, I want to live there someday." And I said, "Well, you'll be so far away." But now they're living.
Yeah, but I think also like to be Swedish, especially during now this corona pandemic, to be Swedish and to live in Sweden, it is a privilege. And I think many of us have come to realize, first of all, how beautiful Sweden is, because now everyone stayed this summer, and also what a good life we have here.
Yeah. Well, I haven't heard much about the COVID and the pandemic. How are how the Swedish government and the Swedish people?
I mean, we did. Almost the entire world have heard about Sweden because we did the opposite to what everyone else did. We were never in lockdown, and there were never any restrictions except for we can't gather more than 50 people at one place, and you know, we're not allowed to sit close to each other at the restaurant. But we never, you know, it was always like, you know, to be responsible and to use our own, you know, common sense and to follow the guidelines that our government gave to us. So we had quite many, unfortunately, many old people died, and not many others. So because it actually came into the elderly homes. And apart from that, I feel that we have been very, you know, blessed because our economy is still running more or less, and people, this herd immunity that they are talking about, we actually think it's working. But now it's just to keep it, you know, to not give it too much slack, and because it's racing now again. So I think it's very tricky. Yeah. But I know that our country did the opposite to all other countries, and they said that Sweden is crazy. But yeah. We who lived here, you know, also when we're talking about mental health and depression, what does it do to a depressed person to be home alone for 3-4 months, you know, to be laid off work and so on. So I think for Sweden, and also coming into the dark season, I think it's really, really good for us. It's crucial for us to not be in lockdown.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that probably soon after the news kind of went through the news cycle in the United States. And I remember hearing people just aghast that a country, and the way they portrayed it in the media is like, they made it seem like it was unconscionable. And I think it,
first,
you know,
yeah, sorry. The first
I don't really think
like
that it was.
Crazy.
Yeah, I don't really think it was, because what it really did is, you know, allowed the process to happen. It didn't devastate the economy, and people are going to get sick anyway. So either you get sick sooner, and as long as it doesn't overwhelm the public health care system here, it will just forestall the number of people who are infected. And I think you're right. The thing that you most need to be concerned about is the elderly or the immune compromised. So I can see the merits of it, but I'm kind of a divergent thinker, which is probably my child is a little bit of the same way. And I think that's why they like Sweden so much. They love the fact that they had Swedish, she felt the Swedish government and the Swedish society really cares for the people and the citizens a lot more than what we experience in the United States, where people, you know, the government actually does things positive for people. Here in the U.S., my kid's kind of jaded and says, you know, here the only thing that's served is the wealthy and the rich. That's what the government serves.
Yes, and I think also in Sweden, I think we now realize, many of us realize, why we have these high taxes, why we pay so much in tax. Because I think now the Swedish government, they paid us back. Because all the people that got laid off, they're still, you know, having a salary, but from the government, and they are supporting all the small companies, the small businesses to not be bankrupt and so on. So I can really feel that there is like the Swedish system is very caring and it's very, very democratic.
Yeah. And so, anyway, it's so nice to hear that. And I'm fascinated. My kid begged me to come visit, and they said, I know you'd love it here, but I was never able to do so. So maybe I'll do it at another time when things change and their ability to travel and all of that kind of changes. Are
you
people
welcome.
Traveling?
You can come visit me also.
Okay. Are people traveling and vacationing and doing that sort of thing, or is that not happening in Sweden right now?
Not really now. No,
yeah.
I wouldn't say. I mean, people can, but I don't see it happening as it normally does.
Yeah.
No, we're very very cautious.
Yeah. So when I do, someday when I do come visit, I also have, I'm from Denmark. My ancestors are from Denmark, which is right across the bridge. Yeah. Exactly. Right outside of Amsterdam. Yeah. Exactly. So anyway, not to have a whole travelogue about Swedish culture, but I'm fascinated mostly just from the experience that my child shared with me. And, you know, and I think that it would be nice to have a perspective from you and your experience growing up and living in Sweden and dealing with the challenges of depression and some of the challenges of being human and the things that we have in common, but also maybe compare and contrast how your society deals with depression and how you in particular dealt with your depression, because it sounds like you had some very dark times and now you've kind of found the light and you've made it through and now you're devoted to helping others. So I'd love to hear your story.
I think that first of all, I come from a family where there is quite a lot of mental health issues. And this, I was not aware of that when I was young, of course, not as a kid either, but my what I'm working at, whenever someone contacts me and say, for example, that they are suicidal or that they, you know, I always ask two things. What are you addicted to and what happened to you in your childhood? Because I know that these two, they always go together. And for me, I'm not, you know, an exception from that. My parents divorced early. I was born into this divorce. And I grew up being kind of excluded from my family. I loved my father, but he didn't live with us anymore. And I longed to be there, but I wasn't allowed to be there. And so I struggled really from early on. And I also suffered from some abuse in my family. And it was really like when I became a teenager, and this is something that I'm really concerned with, I'm writing about in my book also, what happens to us in puberty. Because I find that what we see now is that the highest rate of suicides, you know, is with young girls, and it's also really preteen girls. And it's also, of course, it's about social media, but I'm also thinking what happens to us in puberty. And I feel to become, you know, 13, 14, it's hard enough without having your parents becoming depressed and unemployed and getting cancer and stuff like that. It's really difficult to navigate during those years because you grow and you know, all these hormones and you want to try things and test, you know, limits, and your parents get upset, and there is a lot of things. And I feel that for me, what happened is at the same point, my mom got unemployed and depressed, and we had to move from my childhood home, and my father got cancer. So when I was 15, it was a lot, you know.
Yeah.
In the middle of puberty, I was 14 and a half when my father was diagnosed with cancer.
Okay, can you give me a time frame? Was that in the 70s or 80s?
I'm born 67, so this was 82. Okay. 1982, he was diagnosed, and my mom got unemployed. All of this happened 1982. Yeah.
Okay.
And then, you know, we had to move. I moved three times during 3 years. I lost my friends, you know, three times. And I really know to live in this apartment. When we moved, my siblings, my sisters moved out. So I was alone with my mom. And my father was in a different town dying from cancer. And I became a mess. You know, I began to drink alcohol. I began to, you know, escape. I was a big, you know, I was a great soccer player when I was young.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I can say that soccer and sports, that was my, you know, one of my first addictions. I could, you know, exercise, and that was one way for me to, an outlet for anxiety. And then alcohol came, and then boys came too. So I kind of juggled this during a few years, and and got more and more, you know, upset parents, and, you know, I was kicked out from home, and there was a, my life was a mess when I was 17, and I had really no parental support. So I moved away from home when I was 17, supported myself and tried to finish high school, and then my father died. So I was 18 when he passed, and I would say that when I was 18, 19, I was an alcoholic. I really could not drink every night. So So that's when my first depressive, you know, thoughts, they began when I was maybe 14. And they kind of stuck there to me. And so my first suicide attempt was like 1 year after my father passed away. I was engaged with a criminal person, and, you know, there was a lot of mess, really, really. And so we used to joke. I got pregnant when I was 20. And in my family, we could joke, you know, about the time when I was an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that never left me, you know. It was there, right. But I got pregnant, so I stopped drinking, and I totally shifted my life.
Right. Okay. And you have four children.
Yeah. I have four children. So I have with this. I have the first two with this father that I met, and he was working in the casino, and I was working as a waitress in a nightclub, and. So there was a lot of, you know, just party drinking and so on. And then I was pregnant. So I just changed my life, became a housewife, you know, was the perfect mom for quite a long time. And then eventually we separated and I met another man and we were very much in love. I would say that was my first real love because I was not addicted at that point. You know, I had two small children, and unfortunately he died in a plane crash when I was 26.
Oh man.
So you can see where this is heading,
right? A lot of tragedy.
Yes, I know. And I can see for me being, you know, traumatized as a child, and now then my mom's depression, my father's cancer, and then Stefan died in the plane crash, and I can see that I was not able to handle crisis. You know, I had no resilience, no capacity to, and this loneliness that I've always felt, always since I was like maybe 4 years old, I felt lonely, and so that was 4 months after his death. I tried to commit suicide for the second time, and I ended up in the intensive care, was hospitalized for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. So, and the thing is that back then, this was now 1993. It was not, you know, I was not offered any therapy, any support. I was in the middle of air traffic control education. He died on a Friday. On Monday, I was at school.
Oh,
and I had two small kids, you know, so there was no support. Back then, you didn't talk about depression and you didn't, you know, talk about medication or maybe that she shouldn't continue school. Maybe she should just have a break of half a year or a year and, you know, pick up the studies next year. There was nothing like that. And so I think that a lot has changed when it comes to our awareness. And also in that industry, you know, air traffic control and fighter pilot and so, you could not be, unstable mentally.
Right. Of course, yeah.
It was not and they okay.
Be very wary of addiction or anybody that's going to have a not full capacity when they're dealing with something that's so important for life and death of those passengers. Sure. So, you
And you
know,
can also,
would
yeah,
just
sorry.
I would just ask, so you've seen some dramatic shift or change in the paradigm of the Swedish culture. So now, you know, mental health is more up front and center, and people are more willing to talk about it, and the healthcare system is more willing to address it. Is that something that I'm kind of reading between the lines that you've experienced?
I would say like this, it's top of mind here in Sweden. It's really like depression and burnout syndrome and, you know, mental health issues is on everyone's agenda, but there is no proper help.
Yeah.
That is for me, like why I'm writing this book about depression is for, because most people don't know what depression is. And to wait to be diagnosed with depression, to have 6 out of 9 symptoms of depression is too late. It's far too late. We have to act earlier. And for me to have the awareness that there is so much we can do before we are in a dark hole, you know.
Sure.
It's like to compare it with breast cancer. If you wouldn't seek medical help when you have one lump in your breast, you wait until you have 10. I mean, no one would do that. And for me, so I can see that the Swedish, I don't think it's any different here. There are no mental health clinics, you know, there are nothing emergency, like the doctors prescribe a lot of medicine, and there's really no proper support. And it's the same here. Suicide among young people is the second biggest cause of death, for example. And in young girls, it's increasing.
You know, and your point is very well taken. And in this last generation of kids, we have a whole part of society that's lived with a little phone in their hand. And that connection to social media. I actually, this morning prior to our conversation, the same child that I was describing to you that spent a year in Sweden told me about a movie on Netflix called The Social Dilemma.
Exactly.
Have you seen that?
Yes, I've seen it. And for me, it's scary because I think that drugs and alcohol and, you know, shopping, clothes, or sex, or, you know, relation, that was not invented to make us addicted to it. We can become addicted to it because, you know, we can become addicted to anything. But social media has this built-in addictive components, and they don't know how to get us off it. So for me, that is the scary. Since what I really do a lot is a lot of, you know, work and research around addiction and mental health, and to understand that, I mean, alcohol, we have programs, we know they work. For drugs, we have programs, we know they work. But for this, we don't have anything, and we're talking about a totally different age group. We're talking about like 10, 11, 12 young, you know, girls.
Yeah. Well,
behavior, you know.
Yeah. And especially when they perceive it to be so incredibly important to who they are and their self-image, when you have a group of social scientists and genius technology people that are driving these software algorithms that are doing exactly what you're saying. It's not like alcohol or process addiction or gambling or sex, where it's, you know, it's something that people can become addicted to. In the social media with Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and the like, Twitter, the sole purpose and everything that they do is to get people to use it more and more and more, and the software and the response and how people interact with that software is everything is geared to make them use it more, become more addictive, so they can sell. And basically, for those of you who haven't seen that, I highly recommend you watch it. It's called the Social Dilemma. And basically, the intent is companies, these software companies, are basically selling the access to your personal life. And so they're not selling a product. They're selling you. They're selling your soul, basically.
Yeah, more or less, actually,
for their profit.
Because it's not so easy to tell, to tell a 13-year-old girl, get off your phone. It's not going to work.
Because I don't think they recognize the danger, and they're thinking, oh, it's just a phone, and it's just such a part of our culture. But in Sweden, when you go out, say if you do go out to a restaurant or to a public place, are just people sitting, in the same group, you go to a particular place with a group of people, are they still staring at their screen instead of looking the other people that they're with in the eye? Yeah, so that's no different than here in Sweden, which is, to me, it's just ludicrous.
Yes, that's true. People are like, if you go to the gym, no one is saying hi to anyone. No one sees anyone. Everyone is looking at their phone. And I can't say I'm any different because I'm not. What I am is that I'm super aware and I'm a bit concerned. I can really feel like, okay, how do I get off this? How do I, stop? Because I have so much of my life there. I have my Instagram, I have my friends, I have, there's so much evolved around my phone. But I can just see that when the more time I spend with people in real life, the less I'm on my phone.
Yeah, well,
so I need to add more in real life connection,
or even have, I don't know if it happens in Sweden, but I know for my birthday, I had my last birthday and I said no presents, and the only present to me is that when you come into my home, you put your phone in a basket and we're going to put it in the cupboard. So nobody for the hour or two that you're spending celebrating my birthday, no one's going to have their phone, and life will go on. People will wonder where you are if you're in constant communication, but that's the only thing I asked. And everybody that attended my birthday, just some family and friends, everybody did it, but I caught one person sneaking off and finding their phone. They couldn't do it for an hour.
No.
Or 2 hours.
But this is also, this is also, people now get a little feel of what it's like to be addicted.
Yeah. It certainly is. And, I would submit to you, you're saying, well, how could you, change or stop? And I have done that. And I found myself right when Facebook came out, I found myself just wasting, in my opinion, wasting hours a day just reading about things, and you just keep going and going. And I found myself like, man, I'm not spending time the way that I want to spend my time. And I felt like I was I couldn't avoid being so engrossed in something that after I spent my time doing that, I didn't value the response or the return of my investment, my precious time. So I kind of got away from it. And I'll tell you, because I rarely have ever looked on Facebook. I think I have a Twitter and a Instagram account, and I do text people, friends and family, but I feel like I'm kind of a weirdo that people say, you don't do that. And I'm like, well, and my kid teased me. They're like, Dad, you don't ever do any of that. But now the one that I keep referring to, the one child, after watching this Social Dilemma, they said, Dad, I think I'm just going to do the same. I'm not going to have a social media presence. And as weird as that is for my age group, I just find it doesn't add value to my life. And I'm just going to stop cold turkey. So I think you can do it.
I think that's the best, actually. I think really that's the best. Because I also think you become depressed. there is a big, big risk that you become depressed. And I think they say that the social media entrance is the reason why the suicide attempts and suicidal, you know, the number of deaths has increased so much in young people.
Yeah. You know, can you make a comment on that? Because I have my own opinion, but I'd love to hear, what's the relationship between the increased use of social media, especially in those prepubescent and pre-adolescent young women, young girls, and the increased rate of suicide? Can you kind of share your perspective of how you
see that? I'm guessing, you know, because I'm not an expert and I'm not a doctor, mm-hmm. but I'm guessing. And that is like, when you come into puberty, life is, as I said before, it's going to be difficult as it is, you know, by this change. And in this change, you need a lot of support. And when you have social media, when I was young, you know, I did a lot of sports. I exercised a lot. I think that helped me so much. But nowadays, if you're stuck to your phone all the time and if you have social media, you see what everyone does. When I was young, I didn't know what other people were doing when they were not with me. You know,
mm-hmm.
I had to call them and ask, what are you doing? But now mm-hmm. you see where people are, who are together with whom, you know, if mm-hmm. there is a party, you know, who are at this party, who checked in, and you only post these amazing pictures. And everyone has a social media account, if it's, you know, Instagram, for example, and you only post amazing moments, amazing pictures. And it's so, you know, you compare yourself in a totally different way. And life seems, you know, real life seems to be different than what it is. And when you sit there and look and scroll, it's so easy to become depressed, to feel excluded. I mean, if you're not at this party, the fear of missing out, like my girls say, we never spoke about that. So I think that all this, also the way young girls use makeup. When I was young, you know, I bought my first mascara when I was like 17. So we didn't have anything. So I think it's different back then. Then it was like, if you were depressed, it was a real thing, you know, and it was a few. And the few were those who were really exposed, you know, to trauma or something. But now I feel there is like a depressive kind of mood on society, because there is so much, you know, comparison and jealousy and the feeling that everyone is so much better off than I am. And you know this feeling that to be depressed, you believe anyway that you're a loser. You're nobody. Yeah. There's no point in your life. And if you then go to social media and you see your friends having a really good time without you, of course, it confirms the idea that you're not okay. So I think it's very, very easy to be mirrored and confirmed in this negative spiral that depression can catch you in. That instead of, you know, when I was young, my mom knocks on the door and asks, how are you? What's happening? And or I call a friend. It's not like I put on a screen and I saw everyone that I know being out and about super happy. So I really feel that it's like reality is not in our face any longer. It's something else that is in our face.
Sure.
Which really, I feel that if you're, because everyone has a bad day, everyone has a low, and every day you can see someone else who is super successful and happy and joyous and good looking and smart.
Yeah, and I think your point is so well taken. Is on the Social Dilemma show, they kind of mirrored what you said, and it's kind of we as humans, we're obviously competitive. And so men will compete, you know, in history, men would compete for land, or they compete for wealth, or they political power or to be a ruler or to have influence or to be successful, for whatever that means. And traditionally women would do the same, but it would be about beauty and about also power and riches. And now, as you mentioned, you have young girls. I think they do seem to do has more of a negative effect on girls at that age, where they are competing with a false reality that's portrayed by people who are probably just as depressed as they are, and but give this public persona of having a great time, going out and doing fabulous things, you know, dressing up, and whether it be with makeup for young girls or trying to portray themselves as being having so much fun and creating this public persona that's so discordant with what they're feeling inside. And then the reward is to see how many likes or how many followers or how many people are admiring your pseudo facade of success or, you know, acceptance. And this acceptance is so elusive, and either, you know, it's almost like it's a double-edged sword. If you post something and no one comments, and then no one says, oh, how beautiful you are, and wow, you look so great. So a person would feel bad about that, or a person who had incredible, you know, maybe they're just more pretty or can present their story more effectively. They are under the false impression that, wow, look at all these people are admiring me because they hit a button, when in truth, they may or may not really admire that person if they really knew what was going on inside, you know. So it's such a complicated thing. And I guess other than limiting a parent, you know, limiting how much access a child has to their phone, which is a trouble in and of itself, there has to be other ways for conscious parents who really care about their children to get them to realize there are other things that are more important. And I think that's the challenge, because these kids, they think it's the most important thing in the world. This little device in their hand.
I think it's also so scary, because I think, as you said, it's a double-edged sword. That I think it's also because it feeds also the narcissistic personality. You know, the celebrities now, anyone can be famous, anyone can be someone thanks to social media and the aspiration to become. So I think we're also living in a very much me, myself, and I culture, much, much more than when I grew up, because you see kind of normal people being famous all of a sudden. A YouTuber, for example. Before, you had to be really great at sports, or you have to be like a singer or an actor to be famous. But now it's like anyone can be famous. And I think that also that the aspiration that we are in a society where success and beauty and power and money, you know, when all of these kind of superficial attributes have become the essence, instead of love and kindness and support and connection, you know. So I feel that, because it's really like that's what social media is feeding us with. And I think that what mankind, what we need is connection and love and support and care. So right. I think it's hard to be, you know, in a way I feel it's more difficult, even though we are more socially connected, we are more socially disconnected, I feel.
When you say
it's like
you're
more superficial connection.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get at, is when you say you were more socially connected, you have immediate access to thousands of people who you may know on the periphery, but you have, most people probably have, you know, 6 or 8, maybe 10 people who really, really know them, really, really care. And if you're in a state of emergency or a crisis, how many people would drive across Sweden or get on public transport to come and help you if you're in a time of need? you know, and I think people get the misguided notions like, oh, I have all, you know, I'm not saying you in particular, but I'm saying especially these younger kids that like, oh, I have all these followers. Well, how many of those people would actually take your phone call and talk to you or listen to you if you have a problem or come and help you if you need something? I bet most kids would be, you're lucky if you have a few. And we kind of, and so that's where it's so many people, they talk about addiction, and the biggest challenge with addiction and addiction recovery is feeling isolated. So how perplexing and ironic, someone who wants to be accepted and wants to, you know, feel special or be admired, and this social media that the algorithms are all intended to make you feel like you're accepted and are a part of a community, and yet because it's so phony, you even feel more isolated, even though you probably almost the more pseudo connections you have, the more isolated you may feel. So maybe that's it's certainly not, you know, as you described, we're just making conjecture, but it seems like there's some truth to that.
Yes, I think, and I think also, like, if you are struggling with addiction, to go on social media is like the worst you can do, I would say. I mean, it's much, much better to go to an AA meeting or an NA meeting, or, you know, to seek up real connection in real life than to go to social media.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, I'll just give a plug to someone that I talk a lot about. A gentleman named Mike Speakman, and I've had him on my podcast a few times. He put together a program that helps parents of addicted loved ones. It's called PAL.org, and it's now has all sorts of chapters all over the United States. It's been very helpful. But he has a premise, and I think it's very unique and it's very appropriate, in regard to how to help kids through that awkward time of adolescence. And his description is that when kids hit, you know, 10, 11, 12, the parent, with the concern for that child development and socialization and going through this awkward period, says, listen, you know, the next 6 to 8 years, you're going to go through a lot of changes. You're going to have hormonal changes. Your body's going to change. You're going to develop breasts or testicles or, you know, and your muscles or and your perspective and how people look at you and interact with you is going to change. And you're going to be confused, and it'll be challenging. And also it's challenging because you will want to be an adult and you'll want to be independent, but in many ways you're not ready to make adult decisions from an adult perspective. So in light of that information, I'm going to change our parenting style. Up until this point, whatever I said was rule, and there was no discussion. And if I said this is what's going to happen, that was the rules. So over time, gradually, I'm going to change our relationship, and I'm going to coach you and help you through this process. And what that means is we're going to have to work together. I'm slowly going to give you more responsibility and more autonomy for you to make your own decisions about how you spend your time, what you do, where you go. In regards to alcohol and drugs, I can't forbid you from ever using them. That's kind of unrealistic. But I hope that if I give you the freedom to experiment with those, that you make good choices and we can talk about it. And so anyway, that's his perspective. He's kind of developing a book on that concept, but it sounds as though you're kind of in that same realm to figure out how can we help these kids that are going through this change in this awkward period of teenage angst and ennui to help them individualize in a healthy way. And, you know, he hasn't really addressed the social media, but I think that's in and of itself, that's a whole nother aspect that we have to figure out as a culture and conscious parents of how to deal with that.
I think also that one big problem is also that when the kids come into, like you say, maybe 12, 11, 12, 13 there, I think also many parents are so absent because parents are also so focused on their work. They have their own issues, their own mental health issues, you know. They are also struggling with addiction. And I think that the presence in the child's life decreases, often decreases during these years instead of the opposite. So I have, mm-hmm. what I did with my kids was that the two youngest ones, because I have two who are like 10 years older than the two little ones. Like they're mm-hmm. not so little, they are 19 and 22 now. But with them, I was much more at home, you know. I've always been, and with my youngest, she has always known that this is a phase, you know, it's not me who is the problem, and this is going to pass, and right now I feel like this is not going to stay, and so on. And we are always like in you know, communication about everything, you know, really everything. And so she is the one, after three, I kind of learned, this is how mm-hmm. it's working. This is actually how it is. And I've always yeah. told my kids, even the first one, I said to her, I rather that you take drugs and do drugs and you tell me about it than you yeah. lie to me about drinking alcohol. It doesn't matter what you do. Just tell me so I know where you're at, what you're doing, and instead of you lying to me. Because I think that is the biggest... But I would say it's just my fourth, where I feel that some things that I wished for the other ones actually worked. Because this is also yeah. a thing. As parents, we have no... I was 21 and 23 when my eldest were born. I had no experience. You know, we know nothing. Sure. And we yeah. We take on this job that is the most difficult on the planet. And we think we're going to do better than our parents. But it's so difficult to raise human beings. It's yeah. really.
And there's no training class. There's no driver's education to operate an automobile. But, you know, something that's more important. There's no training unless you just observe your parents and either take the good aspects of their parenting and incorporate that, and then the challenges that you felt in their parenting style, you don't adopt the negative, but you maintain the positive. And so it takes a very conscious person to kind of discern mm-hmm. the two. And I know when you're a parent and you're going through that emotion, because you love these kids so dramatically, that your emotion can get in the way of what's best. And then if your ego gets involved too with parenting, that's why it's so challenging. And it's also not very rewarding for most people, because a lot of times the kids don't appreciate all their parents do for them. They don't appreciate it until they're old enough to be parents.
I think also because when you have a child, you feel the love like you feel for a child. It's like, for me, it was like a love I never felt before. But together with sure. that comes also the fear. Like, if something happens to this person? And yeah. that, I would say, the love and the fear is something that you constantly, as a parent, is juggling, you know, yeah. because life yeah. happens. It happens to me and it happens to them. And, you know, when you have four, it's quite a lot that happens.
Yeah.
During these 32 years.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then also to be struggling with mental health, you know, and also knowing that, okay, I'm very prone to depression. How can I handle this? How can I avoid this happening to me again? What good steps and measurements, how can I live my life? Because I've come to realize I can't live my life as other people casually live their lives. Because I may mm-hmm. die if I don't
yeah.
take caution.
You're consciously on a daily basis creating that your experience rather than just responding or reacting to things that happen to you. Is that kind of what you're saying?
I know that I have to live well. And mm-hmm. I know that I can't jeopardize my health, you know, with not eating well, not sleeping, with having, you know, bad relationships, or I don't do any drugs or alcohol. So I take, like, on a daily basis, I take super good care of myself. And then life still happens to me, and I still go down. You know, when Corona came, I lost my job. I had a conflict with my eldest daughter, and we are super close, so this was very, very painful. And then Corona came at the same time. So I entered a depression, and I could feel it, you know, on Friday somewhere in March. I felt like, and I said to my friends, I have a really strange feeling in my body. And on Tuesday after the weekend, I was going down. And it goes so fast for me. It's like from being okay to being suicidal, it can be 24 hours. So really have to, it's super scary. And so I began to take medication immediately because I've tried it before and I know that it works. Mm-hmm. And so I just called my doctor and I said, I'm going down. I need you to prescribe me the same as I got 5 years ago. So I got that. And then I did one day at a time, one good thing at a time. And I hung out with my sister, with my best friends. They kind of babysat me for a few days. And it's so good because I can really share. I have like 2-3 friends and my sister that I can tell, this is where I'm at. And they know, okay, like we need to do something now. So they are always there for me. And now I always communicate. I never withdraw, you know, even though I know I just want to cut off the phones, you know, not go up, stay in bed, but I don't do that. So I do all the good things that I know I should do. I do them. I'm like my own coach. I'm like, you just do it now. But it's taking a long time to get to this point where I, A, know what to do, and B, actually do it.
Well, and also I think even what you just described is because you have the benefit of having that happen multiple times, now you can identify your patterns. It's like, oh no, this is what happened last time. I have to do something different. When it's the first time, or maybe you're not as aware, you're not even going to know what's happening. And that's when the challenge or the risks of doing the opposite, where you ignore it or you isolate or you shut down from other people. Yeah, so that's a valuable lesson, for you.
Yeah, and I think also people think it's normal to not feel okay. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of, you know, to have negative thoughts, to not sleep well, to feel stressed, and you know, to lose interest for things that you normally enjoy. People think that's normal. Mm-hmm. So people don't feel like, oh, maybe something is wrong. Because it's so easy to think it's just me, you know.
Right.
And maybe there was a conflict. Maybe someone broke up with you. Maybe, you know, something happened and you feel you're a shitty person and then you go down. But you have no idea that I may be entering a depression. Maybe I can do something about this right now, you know.
Yeah. So the difference, what you're saying is the difference is to help identify those that are just having normal human experience with ups and downs that naturally happen, and being able to discern the difference between that and a depression that's so deep that it might cause you to have suicidal ideations or questions. So
mild depression leads to a deeper depression, you know?
Yeah. So unless you take the action,
of course. But I think also people are so used to drinking a glass of wine every day, or, you know, to self-medicate with alcohol, for example, to stress down with alcohol. And then you may end up in a negative pattern that you don't recognize it. And you think that everyone is doing this and everyone feels that they're kind of low in the mood and no one is sleeping these days, you know.
Yeah.
And I sleep like 8 hours, 9 hours per night.
Very
because
important.
I need it. I need it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
Shama, Shama, we're, I just got a note from Robin and we're coming up to the end of the episode. And I just want to thank you for coming on. And if you have just a something to close with and maybe tell us about your book, or if you have something else you want people to know, and to just in the last minute, we gotta sign off.
Yes, yes. No, I'm really grateful to be here. And I actually, I'm one of the few people who love to talk about suicide and depression and addiction. And I do that a lot in my podcast, From Darkness to Light. So I would love to, if you listen to me there and also share with me, follow me on Instagram. You can always comment on posts and ask me things. And I work with Instagram as my platform to support people. So I share a lot there what I'm going through and how it is. Because I also feel that we are so similar. What I'm going through, I know that other people are struggling with the same things. That's just how life is. We're not that unique, you know, even though we are. So I'm just grateful for this opportunity. So if there's anything you want to connect and reach out to me, you're welcome to do that. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And
I appreciate you
coming on today. And I'm sure that the listeners did as well. This is Dr. William Nelson. Thanks, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery. You can reach us at 602-692-4626 or explorehealthaz.com.
Thanks for listening to Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery with Dr. William Nelson. Listen live each week at this time or anytime 24/7 on demand at starworldwidenetworks.com.